You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by the Weather Channel. What does the Weather Channel app share in common with a personal trainer and a life coach? It's an ally on your quest to wellness. What you do with this insight is up to you. Like running an extra mile when air quality is good, or checking your allergy forecast so not even ragweed can disrupt your chi. It's more than a weather app. What in the weather are you waiting for? Be a force of nature with the Weather Channel app.
Episode 50, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format where you can learn about what physicians face through expert analysis. Today's expert is a resident physician, almost a staff physician, Dr. Marty McGrath. Dr. McGrath has created and is almost ready to launch a truly remarkable organization called Hope for Docs, which sounds like it may be rebranded soon to Hope for Responders. Dr. McGrath is a resident physician in psychiatry at Cleveland Clinic, and not only is she raising three children and finishing her psychiatry residency, she's obviously been pregnant a couple times during her residency. She decided in the last 6 months or so, it sounds like, to launch a nonprofit organization dealing with physician burnout. One of the real problems with burnout in physicians in getting treatment is that it's very hard to be confident that the anonymity of the process of treatment. And so Dr. McGrath is looking for a way to find ways of having anonymous discussion groups, actual psychiatric help, and potentially the ability to access pharmaceutical agents directly without using any of the pharmacy benefit managers or group purchasing organization middlemen. All her prices are online and transparent, and there's actually a subsidized portion of that if for those who cannot pay completely. It will be for physicians, nurses, first responders like firefighters, police officers, EMTs, people who might be introduced to trauma, who have to work things out, people who suffer from mental illness, who are functional but still need some assistance. She's already secured the seed money. The website is launched, and she's ready to launch in, I believe, is 8 or 9 states in just a few weeks. I hope you'll find this entrepreneurial story inspiring and as impressive as I did. As I continue to learn that there's no limits to human creativity and the ability to solve problems, and especially ones that unlock market forces, which are more likely to be successful and a way to get an end run around the current system that we think has so many problems as it is. As always, the show notes will be linked at theparadox.com/050. If you're new to the show, please hit the subscribe button. I'd really appreciate it. It costs absolutely nothing. And if you enjoy the show, please feel free to leave a review on iTunes or wherever podcast player you happen to be using, and also share it with your friends, colleagues, and family. But without further ado, my discussion on Hope for Docs with Dr. Marty McGrath. Enjoy. Well, hello, folks. This is Eric Larson. I'm here with my new friend, Dr. Marty McGrath, who is weeks away from being a staff physician and no longer having to say, I'm just the resident. Thank you so much for joining me on The Paradox.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I think one of the most, through your medical training, it's interesting because you start a medical student, and then, of course, you do residency training. And then there's that point where you no longer can say, I'm just the medical student, I'm just the resident. and suddenly there's no one there. You are the backstop, and it's kind right. of it's liberating and unsettling at the same time. So
yes.
I'm sure you'll be fine. Dr. McGrath is training in psychiatry in Cleveland at the mm-hmm. Cleveland Clinic residency program. And I had her on today through recommendation through Ellen McKnight, who met you, and you had a very interesting project, and we'll talk about that in just a moment, Hope for Docs. But first, mm-hmm. I want to find out a little bit more about you and sort of how your journey began getting to medicine and then ending up in psychiatry.
Sure. Well, let's see. I was a chemistry major in undergrad, and both my parents are physicians. My dad's a pathologist. Mom's a pediatrician. And so I kind of grew up in this world. I didn't really plan to go to med school, but I've always loved science. It's always been the thing that has drawn me. And when I was nearing graduation, actually, I think it was at the end of my junior year, I thought, all right, so I have three options. I can either go for a PhD in chemistry, which I thought, my gosh, that's too nebulous. I'm not that creative. Or I can go do industrial chemistry, which I'm sure would be fun. But I thought, you know, not enough, you know, human connection. So I thought, well, you know, I could always apply to med school. So I'm not one of those very authentic people who has always known they wanted to be a doctor.
Yeah.
But
right.
It's funny. It just kind of, I feel like I fell right where I was supposed to be. So.
Well, and my story is somewhat similar in that I never planned on going to medical school. It was one of those things where I went to engineering school at Michigan, did my undergraduate in nuclear engineering, and always the thought that, you know, if I decide to do med school or professional school, you can always do that. And near my junior year, same thing, I sort of thought, thinking, I just don't know that I enjoy engineering enough to do this. I wish you could say, I guess, some great story, but it's sort of like, I guess I'll go to med school. And that was pretty much it. My father's a physician as well. And so, I mean, I kind of knew what it was like. Although I know my kids have a lot different conversation at the dinner table than their friends. And I'm sure it was absolutely the case with you, especially with the mm-hmm. pathologist for a father.
Yes.
You must have had all
kinds. I can identify with that.
Yeah. And then your mom always talking about poop and pee and stuff. Nutrition. So.
Right. Didn't bat an eye.
Yeah, pretty much. So you went to med school, and what drew you to psychiatry?
You know, I think the thing that really just, it still gets me, I think it's never going to go away, is that within, you know, the first 30 seconds of meeting you, somebody is somehow willing to attribute so much trust to you that they will tell you basically anything. And I just am in awe of that. Just such a privilege. I don't know. So that was, kind of had an inkling that I wanted to do psychiatry before I started my clinical rotations. So I wanted it to be first, and I was lucky it was. And so it was kind of like meant to be. I actually, it was between that and anesthesia for a little while. But I know people are like, that's polar opposites. But really, a lot of, you know, pharmacology in each case. So.
I guess. I mean, I think my conversations with patients usually last just a couple minutes, I suppose, unless you're doing ECTs where you're, yours be much longer.
Right.
So you're finishing your psychiatry rotation mm-hmm. or your residency. And, you know, the average person is going to go and find a practice, either go into private practice or work for an institution of some sort, you know, a healthcare system. Mm-hmm. But you thought, that's easy. So I'm going to do something different. So why don't you talk about your venture? And then I'm curious sort of as a follow-up to sort of how you decided on this.
Sure. Well, gosh, where to start?
That's a big question, maybe.
Well, I guess. So actually, I guess all of it kind of started with my own sort of experiences in the field. A lot of circumstances kind of converged. And it was sort of a situation where I thought, wow, can I tolerate this? Or do I just need to find an alternative career? And honestly, I don't know what made me decide to continue with medicine, but I'm so glad I did, because honestly, I can't imagine doing anything else. And then I started to think about the things that were making me consider other paths. And I thought, you know, this is not an insurmountable problem. it can be changed.
So you're in your second year residency, which I always think is kind of one of the harder ones, because you've sort of I imagine your intern year is very similar to most people. You're doing probably half of it psychiatry and half of you just kind of doing transitional year sort of thing. So you spend a year, a month in like surgery, a month in the ICU or somewhere like medicine floor, neurology or something like that. Mm-hmm. So you get a little bit of flavor for the rest of medicine. And then you're sort of your first year as the resident in your specialty full time, moving through different rotations clearly, and you've got different staff with different ideas and different opinions and you're sort of working under them. And so what about that year that concerned you about psychiatry? I mean, was it the charting? Was it the patient contact? What about it that made you really start rethinking whether you should even be there?
Well, I had one particularly unfortunate experience. And I thought, you know, maybe I'm just really not cut out for this. It wasn't something that I did. It was just sort of like a environmental, like, man, I don't know if I want to do this anymore. But overall, I mean, this residency has been just, I mean, the people who are training me are just, you know, compassionate and brilliant, and they really have our backs. So I had a lot of support during that time, and I guess what didn't kill me made me stronger. So,
as it usually does.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I'm in the fortunate bunch. So I had always kind of thought about, you know, what is it that is causing this, what they call burnout. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I continue to use this term is because it's recognizable. It's widely recognizable, sure, as the World Health Organization would tell you. And so we can't fix something that we can't define. So that's why I still use the term. And it kind of just blows my mind what's happening. And the craziest thing about it is that we're so unaware of most of it. And with the physician suicide rate being what it is, you know, 2 to 3 mm-hmm. times what it is in the general population, which is, you know, tragic enough. And surely it's a gross underestimation too, because, you know, on a death certificate, it's often listed as an accidental death or,
right,
you know, 'cause
right,
there's
right.
still the stigma with it. So, mm-hmm. But the things that contribute to what we are identifying as burnout are, you know, the literature says it can be best addressed on a systems-based sort of platform. So, but that's not what we're seeing. And I think over the last 2 years, I've noticed, since I kind of started digging into the healthcare system and all of the things that we are up against, I calculated it one day, and I was spending about 75% of my time doing administrative tasks, most of which really, to be honest, don't contribute to the care of my patients.
Right.
And I'm sure that we can all attest to the fact that medical education requires certain sacrifices. Some of them we can anticipate before we enter it. And some of it, you know, some of these sacrifices are like kind of come out of nowhere. So I have 3 kids. A lot of time that I should have been spending with them was spent on, well, my career, which I don't regret my career, but I made these sacrifices for a reason. And that reason is because it is so rewarding and just so humbling and amazing to actually practice as a physician. I can't think of a better profession, to be honest. It's, you get to keep your mind stimulated. You get to have the deepest human connections you can imagine, and you can make a huge difference in somebody's life. What else could you want, really?
Sure.
But I was noticing that I was spending a lot of time on things that weren't in service of those things.
Right.
And life is too short to waste time. So, you know?
Right. So I guess you'd say you experienced probably early burnout or some sort of burnout symptoms. And you got through that with the help of colleagues and your faculty. And it caused you to just reflect on, you know, why you had it. And then if there's something that you could do to help others to try and either prevent it or recover or, you know, work their way through it as well. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I've talked a number of times in the show. I mean, the number one professional satisfier, of course, for a physician is the relationship with the patient. That's mm-hmm. overwhelmingly what keep people in the profession and drive them to do better. Because even for someone like me who talks to people for a few minutes, I actually have to establish rapport and I get to develop a relationship with the patient. And mm-hmm. I mean, I enjoy the challenge of trying to do that very quickly because I don't have any time. But it's an important part of the job for me, and it's part of the career that makes it rewarding for me. So any time that I'm spent not doing anything that's advancement of anything useful and I'm just collecting data is clearly frustrating, and that's what leads to burnout, especially if it comes in and interferes with your ability to make that relationship, right? I mean, it's one thing if it's you're just doing extra administrative tasks like for medical reasons or something, but if you're doing something that is keeping you from what you should be doing, that's where mm-hmm. the frustration leads. So at some point you came up with this idea of Hope for Docs, which is at hopefordocs.org. Mm-hmm. And why don't you describe what Hope for Docs is?
Sure. So it's kind of could be reduced to the immediate interventions that we're going to be doing, but really it is an organization that is a nonprofit advocacy organization that is meant to support physicians, medical trainees, nurses, first responders, all of these people who have three things in common. So the first one is that they have a direct effect and a responsibility for health and safety and well-being of other people. The second thing is that they have, you know, frequent exposure to trauma, physical, psychological, vicarious trauma, there are a lot of things that fall under the trauma category.
Sure.
And compromised independence because of, you know, strict regulations. And the third thing that really kind of overshadows all of this is that there's an expectation, both external, so societal, and within one's own social and or professional circles, and internal of, kind of superhuman abilities.
Right.
We're expected to be consistently flawless. And that has a lot of implications. So the pressure of not being able to ask for help. So that's a huge one. Not being able to face being seen asking for help. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are licensure concerns, which are very real.
Right.
You can't get disability insurance that's unrestricted if you have any kind of mental health diagnosis in the past. It's just really, it's not a friendly environment in which to get mental health care. So, and the other thing is physicians and other people in this responder category are kind of, because of these extraordinary circumstances that they have to face all the time, they react to it. It builds up over time, and then I can't imagine anyone not being affected by it. So we are set out to provide mental health care, so psychiatric care and counseling, and also non-clinical support. So peer support that's through a HIPAA compliant interface, but we're very focused on evidence-based interventions and so that's one piece of it, but really the biggest part is that we want to join this big revolution of kind of opening the door to another way to deliver medical care, because what we're seeing is that there's third-party interference. So insurance companies compromise the quality of care. They take mm-hmm. all of our time. We're not authorized to provide the care that we believe is really the best, interferes with the doctor-patient alliance, and then it leads to inescapable administrative tasks that exist for reasons beyond the welfare of our patients. So I this is a little bit dark, but I liken it to learned helplessness, kind of.
Yes.
So it's incredible. So essentially what we learn in all of these regulations is that we aren't able to get out of it. And I can see why. I mean, our society is so insurance dependent mm-hmm. and it's going to be like that for a while. But we're not helpless, and this isn't we don't have to be, we don't just have to let it happen. I would say though that a big component of the problem is the fact that so many medical specialties are hospital dependent. I'm sure you can, you have an appreciation
sure,
of
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So you're employed, you mean? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fascinating. And this is something I didn't actually pick up when I reviewed your website and was looking through things. It's very interesting because you not only are looking for ways of, I guess it's the sort of the standard view of this is, oh, we're providing mental health services for medical professionals who are facing trauma, who are facing burnout. And what I think the neat part about this is you're saying, well, a lot of the part of burnout is this learned helplessness. It's because of the administrative burden. It's the third party payer system. So we're going to make sure that our system that we're using to help treat people doesn't contribute to the burnout itself.
Exactly.
And that's really, I mean, that takes a lot of introspection to kind of figure that out. So I think that's a really great idea. And so you're almost like you're almost a two-part pronged in that sense. You're an advocacy platform as well as treating the symptoms, right? You're like treating and prevention.
Right. And I really think the biggest, most important piece of this is that, yes, people need access to really safe, very easy, affordable mental health care, but we have to get to the root of the problem or else nothing's ever going to change.
Sure. Right. So,
that's what we're trying to do.
And so on your website, I mean, you have fully transparent pricing, which is not the case most places. and I think you have a sliding scale for people who may not be able to afford the full cost of the care.
Right.
What's your feel for mental health? I guess the access to it for physicians is it necessary to have a sort of almost like a totally third party system like you have, where you're not even like within the same healthcare system where the physician might be practicing? Is that important for privacy reasons or for career reasons to not have that stigma that the doc may carry around?
Yeah, I really think it is. Obviously, I'm biased because
right, you're setting up the system.
This is very important. But I think there are so many different things that we see that contribute to people's avoidance of care. And regardless of what might be the ultimate outcome of seeking care within an integrated system, a lot of times that's enough to deter people's seeking care. And so we really want to take all of the questions out of that. And I think, unfortunately, in many cases, there is a danger to seeking care within a system that is very intertwined with, you know, a hospital chain or a school, and that's absolutely not to say that there's anything unethical going on. And while like Ohio's physician health program is, I'm sure, just among those that are very ethical above the board, the people who run it, I have a very high opinion of them. But we see all of the stuff in the press about PHPs and how there are all these investigations and questions about, conflicts of interest, making physicians pay for, you know, really involved treatment out of state.
Right.
And so
I guess to define a PHP is most, I think all states have these right now. They're basically what the physician health plans, is that what the PHP stands for?
Physician health programs, yep.
Yeah, health programs. And so this is something very common if you have a physician with, say, a substance abuse issue. And so you might hear lots of people say, oh, they're, you know, a PHP. So you might have to, you know, pee in a cup at certain random times, or you have to go through a detox program or rehab program, something like that. And so if there's anyone who is felt to be unsafe to practice, I suppose, they're placed in these programs, and that's what you're referring to. And so your nonprofit is a sort of a way for people to get help before they have to go to some program like this, where, you know, we could assume that it's not known within the health system, but if you're in a city with one or two health systems, it's going to be probably hard for someone in the administrative portion to not know that someone isn't participating in one of these programs. And so they're going to, even if they may think that you're doing well or whatever, they're going to have a, you know, they're going to have a, you know, they're crosswise at you, right? Or they're going to be watching more carefully or whatever. And maybe things that ordinarily wouldn't be concerning, they're going to look at and say, maybe this person's, you know, bothered by whatever, when it was, you know, just whatever, you know, may just not have been anything, but their perception's going to change of you.
Exactly. And I think it's, I mean, I don't find any shame in psychiatric illness. I think, you know, it's so common. I mean, half of us have some kind of diagnosable psychiatric illness in our lifetime. So it's really commonplace. But it still has the stigma. And of course we are not going to, we are just absolutely ironclad unless there's, you know, concern for safety, because of course we don't want anyone to be practicing in a dangerous way or, be in a position to harm themselves or anybody else. But, you know, we aren't going to give your information to any of these companies that index it or sell it, or any of that. We're completely independent, and that may not be necessary, but we just want to make sure that we are safe.
So, you know, the service you offer, I mean, many of them are straightforward, at least just looking at there, you have psychiatric care, you provide subsidized care for the psychiatric programs.
We're working on that. Yep.
Right. And right. I mean, obviously, with funding that will come along, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Stigma reduction, advocacy, anonymous discussion groups, those are fairly straightforward. So I thought it was very interesting. You also have a no strings pharmacy. And it's not set up. I realize you're still working on that, because it's probably, from a regulatory standpoint, it's probably somewhat of a nightmare with you have 50 pharmaceutical regulatory boards trying to figure out.
A little bit.
But what is your vision for this no string pharmacy? I mean, are you just looking at psychiatric meds, or what exactly is the plan?
Well, so pretty excited about this, actually. A few months ago, I was at my pharmacy. I won't name it, but I'm sure you can guess. And I discovered that my medications with my insurance were about 31% more expensive than they would be if I went through GoodRx or another.
You don't say. Like, I've never heard of such a thing.
I know. Aren't you shocked? So I was like, man, this is enough. I can't contend with this anymore. And I thought, you know, every time we prescribe something for someone through our organization, they're going to have to go to one of these pharmacies. And it really sits not very nicely with me that they're making all this profit on my patients' backs. Mm-hmm. I think it's dirty. It's not transparent. I mean, the very concept of informed consent is not happening in our healthcare system right now, which is, people need to know what's happening. And not in a conspiracy theory kind of way, just really transparency, objectivity. And so that is what we want to do with this pharmacy. So basically what we want to do with this pharmacy is we're going to be purchasing medications directly from a wholesaler. Mm-hmm. And so that completely cuts out the GPOs and PBMs. So there's no additional profit going to people or middlemen that don't add anything to the value of what we're doing, of course. And, you know, we're going to be just super transparent about the costs. Some medications actually are going to be less expensive than you would be able to get them at a typical pharmacy. And some might not be, but we have a few ideas for that too. So we really just don't want people to have to pay way too much for their medications.
I've interviewed a number of direct primary care physicians, and I mean, this sounds in many ways like you're setting up a nonprofit that's on we'll say national scale. I know you've rolling out to a certain amount of states, and I imagine your intentions eventually to all 50 states at some point, but you're kind of having a direct primary care sort of feel to it, that you offer pharmaceutical supplies. You don't have a direct patient relationship in the sense that there's a membership fee or anything like that, but you're just going to have, I guess, all sorts of different aspects of it, which is very interesting. I mean, and as much as you talk about the learned helplessness, which I totally agree that, you know, most of us have for all sorts of things, whether it's, you know, an annoying speed limit on the road or whether you have to follow some sort of dumb rule in the hospital and collecting data that you don't, you know, doesn't affect patient care. But you see physicians more and more, I feel, are finding innovative ways and being disruptive, mm-hmm. not in bad disruption,
right.
but disruptive in the market sense, where they are actually mm-hmm. finding good workarounds in the system. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're setting up a nonprofit that for psychiatric care for physicians and, well, all healthcare professionals mm-hmm. and providing these, you know, pharmaceuticals, I suppose the ultimate goal, mm-hmm. and all fully transparent. And there must have been something that was it. I mean, there must have been some reason you came up with this idea, right? I mean, who are you watching that you came up all these? You didn't. I can't imagine you came up with this all on your own.
Well, I would say,
if you are, you're really brilliant. Just so you know.
No, I would say I do a lot of reading and a lot okay. of plotting.
Yeah.
Not to sound nefarious or anything.
Right. No. I'll take it over the world. All that.
It's kind of like. I'm a problem seeker, I guess, because I think it's just really exhilarating to see a problem and just think, wow, there's actually a workaround for this that is viable and realistic and easy to implement. It's really exciting. And I think psychiatry is the perfect place to start with something like this. And really, among other reasons, one of the biggest drivers for our goal to become a national corporation is that if this is widespread enough, if people really unite, and we're seeing this happen all over the place, mm-hmm. it's going to be really powerful. And I think we have a pretty good chance of actually changing the tide. It's not we, this organization, but we as, you know, a physician community, physician, patient, everyone else community. This, all of this stuff affects everybody in our communities, whether they know sure. it or not, which is really scary. And I don't want to see this mass exodus of physicians anymore. I don't want to see them dying. I don't want to see them leaving because they can't tolerate it anymore, because the purpose and passion has left their profession. We're going to be in trouble if all the physicians are gone. So,
sure. If we thrive, then the patients thrive.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, you're not going to provide good care if you're not taking care of yourself mm-hmm. and doing well.
Right.
And that's not just a physical thing, but that's also the emotional and mental aspect of, mm-hmm. of medicine.
Yeah.
So the next obvious question. So you've created this Hope for Docs, and which is a great name, great segue. Where's your funding coming from? How big of the staff do you have? What sort of, you know, what's the infrastructure for this project? Because, I mean, honestly, when I was a resident, I was pretty excited if I figured out where I was going to get my meal the next day to come up with like a 501c3 and build all this stuff. And you have three kids. You may have more hours a day than the average person. I'm not sure.
Wish I did.
So, I mean, who do you have with you? How many other physicians are in this venture? All that sort of thing.
Sure. So, let's see. Back in March, my co-founder came on. Her name is Kim Wilton. She has worked in kind of administrative capacity, and she's also been a mental health tech for the children's PHP here in the area. And she is brilliant beyond, she doesn't even realize it. but she is just an extraordinary individual. She's so smart and so organized, and she's really the heart behind this. And so, you know, with her support is how this is happening. We applied for the 501c3 back in February. And the IRS, I hope you're sitting down, had a 12-day turnaround time. So that
what?
Was, I know, I couldn't believe it. I just thought, man, this is...
When you're telling me that you met her in just March, you're talking about March of this year, right?
Oh, no. She just, so actually,
March of last year?
So I worked with her 2 years ago when all of this okay. sort of started. We had no contact until probably February of this year. So the organization was established in November of 18. Just because I was like, it was really, I mean, I'll be honest, I think it's sort of, there's a big component of self-preservation. I feel like if there's this opportunity and it's easy to do it, what reasons do I have to not? So that's really what it was. And then And then she came on, and it's been rolling. So now it is Kim and me. And then we just hired a COO who is, oh my gosh, she's a powerhouse. She has raised over $650 million for over 100 pretty prominent nonprofits, which would be highly recognizable on a national level. And so she is just, she's amazing. And so then we have about seven doctors who are spanning the seven states that we are going to be launching in. And they're going to be contractors for us at the outset. And then we've got our board of directors. So we're actually kind of in the process of building that right now, but we have an attorney and a pharmacist and a couple people who've got business degrees. And then currently on our board is an RN, and we've got a police officer who's probably going to be joining our board pretty soon. And so we've got lots of support. And as far as the financial support, really, I don't know if it's smart to say this to the world, but we have a little bit of seed money, and I've been basically supporting it by moonlighting. So, but it's low overhead, which is really awesome. And that's, yeah, it's just going to make it so much easier to serve as many people as possible. And so we're really excited, and we're going to be doing some like music and art therapy programs in the Ohio area at first. And then we're going to have probably a gardening program for the children of first responders and physicians. So we've got some other projects in the works, but
I was amazed when you said that Iris turned around in 12 days, but I'm frankly more amazed that we're recording this here the first week of June. And you said, we brought some people on in March, and in 3 months, you've got a CEO who's raised hundreds of millions of dollars for other nonprofit organizations. You've created a board. You've got pretty good looking website, and you have all your services kind of mapped out, and you've already found seven physicians to work. I mean, you've been pretty busy. Are you like not in rotations right now, or are you doing this? Is this all just you doing on the side, or like weekends or something?
Yeah, you know, it's been basically a nights and weekends thing for me. I do sleep. Wow. Don't worry. but it's I don't know. It's what I do for fun these days, I think. I mean, it's just exciting because there are so many people who are really invested in this mission. Because I would say probably everyone has some kind of connection to a first responder or a nurse or a physician, and they know what's going on. And so and the reason actually that we have this incredible COO is because she gets it too. And mm-hmm. she's way out of our league. we're pinching ourselves. Like, how did we, her name is Julie Forgash. And we just think how is this happening? So I think really this organization kind of has a mind of its own. It has a life of its own, not in a creepy way, but it's really, it's running itself. It's just, of course it takes some attention and TLC, but it's so enjoyable. And I think it has great potential, and it's really pretty incredible that we have such an opportunity, because this is something that we can implement very easily on a huge scale. And on top of that, it's something that is so needed. It's like a perfect combination. So, if we can secure the funding that we hope we can, I'm not too worried about it. Maybe I should be, but
yeah,
I think the outlook is good, and I think people are really going to be behind it. And I hope what happens is that we can gain enough, numbers that we can really sort of open the door to this happening in other fields. If we will expand to primary care and join the DPC movement in the future. Who knows, maybe based physicians will have an option if the, step Z put in play.
Right. Well, it's pretty exciting. And to do all this while you're resident, I guess that's the part that amazes me. I guess, senior residents, you have a little bit more time often if it's like most residencies, but still, it's very interesting because I've talked to so many physicians now who are, I guess it's more entrepreneurial than others. And I would not consider myself entrepreneurial. I mean, this is like the most exciting venture I've done is just making this little podcast, but
for people to
actually, oh, well, thanks. But it's, and it's also a testament to how weird physicians are that we think it's kind of fun to do all these sorts of things.
I know.
Like in my spare time, I put together a 501c3 and, you know, raise my kids and do this sort of thing. But it, I can definitely see your chemistry training in the background in this, as you're watching these pieces come together and you're sort of building something like you are like a compound, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it's pretty much the same sort of mindset. Mm. Well, I'd recommend anyone to go to hopefordocs.org. If you have someone who's, I guess, got problems or, you know, someone who might benefit from this service or who might want to get involved, right? I mean, I think that's probably a good place to contact you.
Mm-hmm. That'd be great. We are absolutely open to volunteers. We're hiring physicians. We're hiring therapists. We are in the process of growing and we're actually rebranding a little bit. We're going to be called Hope for Responders. And the way we're defining responders is, you know, these people who have responded to this calling to, you know, help other people. So that's what we're going to be.
As long as it's not providers.
Oh my gosh. That word is like, oh, no.
I just can't handle it. It's like, it's like nails on a chalkboard to me now. Yep. So
right. I'm with you.
Okay. Where else can people find more about you? I mean, I'll have lots of things in the show notes page, which is theparadox.com/050. Where would they find more on you on Twitter, Facebook, internet, all those sorts of things?
So we are currently building our social media platforms. We do have a Facebook page. And once I have a little bit more time, in 2.5 weeks, it'll be on. So, pretty much the website. We've got a lot of contact us forms. We've got our email address and lots of different ways to contact us. But info@hopefordocs.org is probably the easiest way at this point.
And is there a way to follow you on Twitter or is that something?
Oh, there will be. So we've got a Twitter account. We've got an Instagram account and those are about to roll out in the next few weeks. So it's all a work in progress, but we've got a very, pretty concrete plan at this point and we've implemented some of the stuff. So we're going to be actually launching our clinical services next month in our first 7 states. So, you know, if you're interested in becoming a patient or joining a group, hop to our website. And, I guess the other big thing is that we, as a grassroots organization, we really want to be what people need. Barring breaking the law, we'll do anything if it's going to help. So if you have ideas, we love feedback. We're going to be begging for feedback forever, pretty much. So,
I feel like I do for this podcast as well. I think, it's important to have humility to recognize that you don't have the answers and you don't have the solutions all the time. But if you find the problems that may there, you can try to sometimes work out, ways of fixing them, but until you know about them.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I really appreciate it. So we'll look for more for you from Hope for Docs and then Hope for Responders. And that'll still be .org, I imagine, too, at some point. The last question I have for you is this program, I mean, you're hoping to launch it nationwide. Mm-hmm. How are you looking to get people who are generally pretty busy and not paying attention to this sort of thing to know and learn about your organization? How are you going to get nurses and EMTs and physicians to find out about you?
Yeah. So basically we are going to diversify. We're going to be using absolutely every marketing technique there is because the first obstacle is getting people to know about us. So we're going to be doing lots of social media stuff. We've actually got our explainer video in the editing stages right now. So we're pretty excited to see that. And we're going to be doing ads. We're going to be traveling around to talk to fire stations, police stations. And then of course our board is going to be integral to the communication process because they have lots of connections. And we're also working with John and Michelle Deal, who are the parents of Dr. Kevin Deal, who died by suicide just before he graduated from medical school. So they have been an immense support for us too. And we really want to do right by them. So.
Well, and I lie because I actually have one other question. So I think it'd be pretty straightforward for police and fire and many of these services to reach out to an organization that's going to be providing mental health services for their employees or an opportunity. I see it a little differently with health systems because in some ways, you know, promoting you is in some way sort of undermines their system, whether, whether they have mental health services within their organization or not.
Sure.
Certainly if they do, they'd be less likely to try and to recommend their, their nurses and physicians to go seek help elsewhere.
Absolutely true.
And also, and I just wonder how, I mean, I hope you're successful. I guess I don't know what your plans are to try and penetrate that because, you know, I imagine there'll be some resistance there within the health system because they like to think that just by, you know, giving some donuts at a meeting or something, that's going to fix the, the burnout issue.
Yeah. You know, I think of course that's going to be an obstacle. There are a lot of obstacles that we are actively anticipating and we've got like plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D for almost everything.
Yeah. Right.
But really what it comes down to is that people are savvy about the issues that we're facing today. And people are pretty savvy about what's going on in our healthcare system. And I think that people are probably not, you know, most people aren't completely pleased with how the system is. And they don't necessarily always know why it is how it is, because there is a very worrisome lack of transparency. But we are also here to educate. We want to illuminate the things that people don't know about. And I think people are becoming very wise about what we're seeing. So I think they will seek us out on their own.
Well, Dr. Marnie McGrath, thank you so much for this conversation. This is really, really interesting that you've set up this whole thing on your own, mostly. and that you got it all up and running in a relatively short period of time. And I think it sounds like it could be a tremendous asset and value for lots of people. So
thank you so much.
I wish you the best of success. Oh, you're very welcome. And thank you so much for being on.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.